Hey guys, you're listening to Tech Traction. We are your hosts, Carolyn and Sohini. Our guest of the day is Dr. Hartman Levin. He's a distinguished scientist working in quantum computing, computer vision, robotics, and computational neuroscience. He is best known for his pioneering work in object and face recognition and his contributions to quantum machine learning. He is also the co-founder of the Google Glass project.
He co-founded two companies, iMatic, for which he served as CTO, and Levin Vision, which he initially led as CEO. The latter was acquired by Google in 2006. He managed teams responsible for advancing Google's visual search technologies. He was also the engineering manager for Google Goggles. He is currently the director of engineering and a distinguished scientist at Google, where he is leading the Quantum Artificial Intelligence Lab, which he founded in 2012. Welcome, Doctor.
Hello. Firstly, Doctor, can you tell us how a quantum computer works and how it differs from a classical computer?
Okay. So the easiest way to explain the difference between a quantum computer and a classical computer is to say, we all know, already kids know, that a classical computer is using the language of zeros and ones as a native language. So mathematicians call this Boolean logic. So all processors that all of us pretty much have ever touched are operating on Boolean logic. And a quantum computer is distinguished in the sense that it replaces the Boolean logic by the laws of quantum mechanics. Yeah, and as a result of that, you get a generalized set of operations. So there are new operations that Boolean logic doesn't know. For example, many of us know that in Boolean logic, you have the operation not. You know, so not of a zero is a one and vice versa. But in a quantum computer, you have an operation called the square root of not. So that's a new operation that in classical Boolean logic you don't have. And now, with this richer set of operation, you can do certain algorithms with fewer steps, and sometimes with dramatically fewer steps, exponentially fewer steps. And that, of course, leads then, or not of course, but calculations show that this would lead to dramatically reduced computation times for certain tasks.
That's really amazing, Doctor. In the video, A Scientific Theory of Consciousness, you mentioned that quantum computers can help us understand consciousness better. Can you please elaborate on this?
You're going right to the most difficult topic. this is a very loaded area, so allow me to digress a little bit. Please interrupt me if it's not clear. Science, like physics, or pretty much any science, describes the world from a third-person perspective. You know, there's something happening on my tabletop experiment in the lab, and then physics is there to describe what's going on. But we all possess another perspective, the first-person perspective. So we experience the world immediately, and that is a different perspective. And we still have not a good way of reconciling those two perspectives. And it has always fascinated me, what is this about? The phenomenon of consciousness, essentially, is the word for how I experience firsthand the world. So this is the reason I think quantum computers may be able to help us here is, There are many approaches how you can think about consciousness. You know, there are religious approaches, but within the confines of science, I think many of us would subscribe to what is a materialist or a physicalist point of view, which says that all phenomena in nature are ultimately explainable by configurations of matter or evolutions of matter. And if you adhere to this general view, then you would postulate that there is what is called the physical correlate of consciousness. There must be some chunk of matter, could be some nerve cells in the brain of a human or a mammal. It could be some cells within or subcellular structures within a cell. We don't really know, but there would be some physical house of consciousness. And one thing we understand, or at least our current understanding would suggest, matter is governed by the laws of quantum physics. And a quantum processor can therefore simulate matter much better than any classical machine. And actually, to the extent that classical machines would never be able to simulate it. So it stands to reason, if you wanted to simulate the physical correlate of consciousness better, a quantum processor would be a great tool to have. There's many more things to say about this, but just to get the connection, why does quantum processing have to do with consciousness?
Yeah. Okay, so now I'll move on to our next question. It is about the bootstrap paradox. According to this paradox, once we go back in time to alter something, we get stuck in an endless loop of cause and effect. This is basically the crux of almost all time travel fiction. It was also recently made famous by this mind-bending Netflix series, Dark. It is actually a German series. Okay, so this series also involves multiple worlds and realities. So I understand that a possible way to resolve this paradox is by using the multiverse theory. So what are your takes on this?
Oh my God, you ask like really out there questions. So, and also you put several big concepts into one sentence. So we should maybe separate even though it's related, we should separate the issue of the multiverse from issues of time travel. So I have a colleague on my team that Edward Fay used to be the director of the Center for Theoretical Physics at MIT. And once over a nice dinner, he explained to me that he designed a machine that would allow for time travel, if I recall this correctly, where you could go back in time. But he told me that the results were rather disappointing because he determined that you would need half of the mass available in the universe to achieve this. So pretty much impractical. We haven't hadn't discussed sort of the different sort of paradox that reside. I know there's a hierarchy of paradox, and one is, yeah, what happens if I travel back and prevent my mother from meeting my father? Would I then not be there? You know, you have this loop. I think the way this is typically approached is that you assume that causality needs to be maintained, and that therefore laws that would govern such situations, like here you would definitely need to involve, let's say, in the machines that I just described, the laws and relations of general relativity would be of relevance. But my understanding is that the application of such laws you would have to do in a way that it doesn't violate causality. Yeah. There are other few interesting things to be said about it. There is obviously the laws of physics tell you what programs you can write. You know, so you have your program, you know, and if there is suddenly an instruction, let's say instruction 5, go 5 steps back in time, or go 3 steps back in time. You know, right now we cannot write such a program, but if you had it, you know, this would be an interesting construction to have in your program. And if it actually turns out, if you had, and maybe not surprisingly, if you had operations like this, then you would have way more power at your hand. And suddenly things like NP-hard problems, which we believe with a normal quantum computer you could not solve, if you had time-like curves, then those would become open to solution. So a quantum computer which would have access to such general quantum gravity effects, if I may call it that, would be way more powerful than the quantum computers we consider at the moment. So none of this is related yet to the notion of multiverse mm-hmm. that you mentioned. But of course, there is an interesting book. It's called The End of Time. And it points out the general possibilities that you can, let's say, normally how we visualize time. Time is a one-dimensional parameter, and it sort of parametrizes a family of configurations. And you could, in principle, think of take all the different configurations the system can be in at different points in time, and now imagine you spread those configurations out, and they all exist at the same time, and now you sort of hop, let's say, from one world to the other. This would be an alternative view. So in some ways, many worlds, and not necessarily in the average sense, but many universes or many configurations, and the parameter of time is the situations you get there to some degree exchangeable. So in that sense, it touches a little bit. But that's not what's normally meant when you talk about the multiverse picture of quantum mechanics, which I'm happy to explain, but this is a little bit...
Okay. Thank you so much for explaining.
So, Doctor, a recurring theme in several dystopian sci-fi movies and television series is the possibility of uploading human consciousness into quantum computers. This theme forms a central part in the plots of the 2014 science fiction movie Transcendence and the satirical drama Upload. Do you think that quantum computers can mimic or store something as complicated as the human brain?
The acoustics was a little choppy, but I think I understood what you asked. There is. Let's maybe start from that end. Quantum mechanics, you know, we all know there is a copy and paste operation in normal.
Yeah.
We use it every day. In quantum mechanics, there is no such thing as copy and paste. There's only cut and paste. Yeah. And moreover, in quantum mechanics, there exists what is called the no-cloning theorem. So you cannot essentially make an exact copy of a general quantum system. You know, only certain special states can be copied. Now, what that means is if our brains would use quantum effects in a functional manner, then, or in an essential manner, then we would not be able to exactly copy it. So this idea, I upload my consciousness into a computer, would at a minimum require a quantum computer, if this is correct. You know, we don't really know whether quantum effects do play a functional role or an important enough role in the function of human nervous system. But personally, actually, I think they do. But that's an open question. And if it is correct, then you would need a quantum computer to do so, to cut yourself out here and sort of get yourself back within the confines of a quantum computer. Now, in principle, that's probably possible. Of course, the engineering challenges would be tremendous. We have, if I recall the number correctly, about 100 billion neurons in our head. in our Cortex. Currently our machines have 50 qubits. Yeah, you do the math. And probably it's a bad thing to think that one neuron equals one qubit. A neuron is a very complex device that needs many qubits in itself. So you would need an inordinate amount of qubits to do so. But maybe in 100 years from now, we could look into trying things like that.
Actually, in that series upload, what they do is after the person dies, so that they can interact with that person further, they just upload the brain and the consciousness into some digital form so that the living people can interact with him or her.
Yeah. That should be doable. Yes.
So, if this is possible by any chance, so what will be the pros and cons of this, which might effectively grant us immortality? Actually.
My God. Any more mundane questions you have? But it's fun. I like it. It's an interesting question. So I think that's a privilege of young people to ask sort of questions. Actually, everybody should ask questions like this. I do like this. I often think like with normal, this is a normal notion of immortality. But what if? Now, recently there were articles that scientists for the first time made measurable progress in slowing down or even slightly reverse aging. I mean, this is all still very early results and not something we can go to the doctor next week and say, hey, please make me 10 years younger. That doesn't work yet. But there were first in reputable magazines like Nature or so, there were experiments reported that, I recall a study, UCLA was involved, and they, I recall the upshot was the physiological age of humans was reduced by 2 years. I forgot what the exact figure of merit was, like telomeres at the end of the genetic code being reduced. Would have to be lengthened. So it doesn't seem completely impossible that, let's say, in 50 or 100 years from now, we figure out how to stop or even reverse aging, you know, and treat it like a disease. That is, in principle, conceivable, and with progress as it goes, you know, we might be the last mortals around. So would that be enjoyable? If sometimes I think, you know, if you have led a rich life, made many experiences, then sort of staying roughly within your apparatus with its sensing and memory and reasoning capabilities, it might just get boring, you know, like there's only a certain set of experiences possible, and eventually, like, okay, I've seen that movie, I've done it, that and that for the nth time now. So I think it would be desirable to be able to consistent or to continuously enhance your capabilities of experience. And of course, once your consciousness sits in a machine, I mean, we know we can make machines bigger and faster and connected with other machines. So they're way more. The technical evolution is, of course, much faster if you just look at aircraft, you know, how they have over the last 100 years, while the human design is basically still the same over the last 100 years. So you would have, in this technological realm, many interesting ways to enhance the capacity for experience, and then it could potentially be interesting to extend for long periods of time.
Okay. So now, going a bit off topic, teleportation. As you all know, it is an immediate consequence of quantum entanglement. One of the main reasons why teleportation hasn't been achieved completely is that it is challenging to maintain the particle's entangled nature for a long time. So what are your views on this? And also, do you feel human teleportation is possible in the near future?
Just to say, it's sort of not a misunderstanding. We often talk about quantum teleportation, but to really achieve it at the probability one, so to deterministically transport something, and again, in quantum mechanics, we discussed this earlier, no, there's no copy and paste, there's only cut and paste. So to essentially do a cut and paste operation and to ensure that it has been properly executed still requires the exchange of classical information. So the picture of like in Star Trek, you know, where they go and then appear somewhere else at a velocity possibly faster than light, this will never be possible. You know, there's always has to be a classical information channel involved. And that is, of course, bound by in its speed by velocity of light. So yes, you will be able to teleport to some degree, but there still would have to be some. Yeah, I'm repeating myself now. A classical communication channel accompanying.
Yeah. Okay,
that was really interesting, Doctor. So the next question is about deepfakes. We already know that we can create deepfakes. But can we create artificial intelligence to spot these deepfakes? And will it be an immovable mountain versus unstoppable force kind of situation?
So, first I might tell you a little story as a background for deepfakes. Actually, the first adversarial pattern, as far as I know, was actually done by a member of my former team, the visual search team. Christian Segedy, and this came about because when he joined our team, he was sort of like a well-trained mathematician specializing in optimization, but he hadn't done much work in machine learning yet. And I told him, hey, I think I have a good startup project for you, a training project. And that was essentially about, at the time, sort of deep networks just made their resurgence. Came on the scene, and they were quite good on spotting, let's say that there was a cat in the image, but they were rather poor localizing the cat. So they were not able, you couldn't easily tell, okay, there's a cat is say on the lower right corner. And then the idea I had is, hey, why don't we turn this around? You know, when the cat node has a high activity in the output node, why don't we change the image a little bit? You know, we modify the pixels until the cat node turns off, has a low activity. And then naively I thought, okay, which pixels would you think are most effective in doing this? You would think it's the pixels on top of the cat or near the cat. So we thought, oh, this would be a good method for localizing objects, which is still actually a bit of a problem in deep networks today. And so Christian did this, but being a trained optimization guy, he formulated it as a global optimization problem. So he asked, what is the minimum number of changes across the image I have to do to turn off the cat node or the object node? And then it turned out that this was possible by doing these tiny changes across the image, and this is now called an adversarial pattern. You know, a human would look at these two pictures, let's say the one with the cat that was recognized, and then the one that Christian changed, where the neural network would say there's no cat. And for the human, it looked indistinguishable, it looked the same, but there were these tiny changes. And that gave birth to the notion of an adversarial pattern, and then it took off from there. Then other people realized, oh, you know, you can turn this around. You know, you can make, instead of just having the cat node go off, you know, you can make the cat node go on, even though this is just a picture of the sky, you know, and there are no cats in there. So that gave a rise of interesting set of techniques. And besides nefarious applications, you know, we call it deep fakes for a reason. It's of course, a very useful technique with positive applications. For example, creating extra training images. Of course, these images are very good training images because, in a way, why did the neural network say there's no cat in there? Yeah. We would say there is a cat. So this is very helpful in training methods. And if you have a situation, let's say you want to make an X-ray detector, automatic one for finding cancer cells, then it would be or cancerous structures, then it would be quite helpful to appeal to adversarial techniques. Now, we recently actually have looked into quantum GANs, quantum generative adversarial networks, because, or I use the word GAN, I should quickly explain this. A GAN is a systematic way of making use of the notion of adversarial patterns in the sense that you set up a game between two networks. One calls a generator network, it tries to make as believable as possible images, let's say face images, and then the second is a discriminator network that tries its best to say this was a synthetic picture or was a real picture that came out of a camera. And then they play with each other, and then if everything goes well, eventually the generator gets that good that the discriminator only with 50-50 can say was a fake image, a synthetic image, or was a real image. And the generator works, there are many, many flavors these days, but the simplest flavor is that it takes an input vector and modifies it to make, let's say, the synthetic face image. And of course, you don't only want a single face image, you want a whole family of them. So typically the input is a set of noise vectors, of seed vectors, which the generator network takes. And these seed vectors are typically drawn from some probability distribution. And often a simple one, let's say a mixture of Gaussians or uniform probability distribution. But the idea we had is that last year when we did the quantum supremacy experiment, we showed in essence that there are probability distributions that you can produce on a quantum computer that are beyond the reach of probability distributions that you can generate on a classical computer. So we are now experimenting with, hey, can we make probability distributions for our generator network with a quantum processor that are beyond the abilities of what classical machines can do? And therefore, we can maybe do even better job producing synthetic images. So there may be a role here for quantum resources in this production of credible synthetic images. This didn't quite answer your question on what an AI would do there, but you get a sense how these things connect.
Yeah,
doctor.
Okay.